first half, second half, like chalk and cheese.
That can't be my best foot, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's no stupid red card, that's for sure.
We'll give you the balls so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh.
I'm not fully keeping it together. Putting the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We're recording this on Monday, April 8th, 2019. Rabbi Mark Goodman, how are you doing this evening, my friend? It's been a while since we've potted on a Monday.
Have we ever potted on a Monday?
I think we did the week of the Boca Friendly last year because that was on a Tuesday, and so we did it like right after, like within 12 hours of the Kellen Acosta introduction presser. But yeah, it's been a while, and it is a rare occasion.
Your knowledge is impressive, my friend.
Oh, thank you. Knowledge that's only relevant for documenting the history, and to my knowledge, I'm not sure anyone outside of you and me really care about the history of Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red.
People care, Matt. A lot of people care about the history of Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red.
And speaking of that, Mark, are we looking in to see stuff about people caring about Holding the High Line to a certain extent financially?
Yes. So Matt wants to point out, Matt's been great. I'm gonna give him almost all the credit. Matt started this podcast and Matt spent the money out of his own beer fund to make sure that the podcast was hosted on Blueberry, which is, I don't understand how these things work, but apparently you need a host and blah, blah, blah. It's like the same as the InterTubes, except maybe less complicated. But anyways, Matt paid his own money out of his own beer funds to do this. And I chipped in, after a little while. But
you did give me at least one beer for a full week when we were podcasting in your basement in Denver, though. So I feel like
there was a lot of free beer, and then I paid for a couple months, and then also I bought you that sweet kit for Monterey. But some of that is just friendship, man. Anyways,
yes, that we might have to be wearing for the CCL final if it ends up being. We got a lot of alliteration going on because I think it's the Regio Monumental is the region in Mexico. So we have Rabbi in Red along with the R, and then Matt and Mark along with the M, and then the M for Monterey as well, and there is an R in Tigre. So We might have to live watch that and then maybe also live stream it as well, just for funsies. And I think we do need to work on a prop bet if it ends up being Tigres against Monterrey in the CCL final. But continue.
Most definitely. But the longer point here, Matt, is that we would love for anybody's help in defraying the cost of doing this show. It's not expensive, but if just two guys shoulder the burden, it's a little expensive. So Matt has set up a Patreon account,
Patreon.
What does it matter? It's tomato, tomato, my man.
Okay.
Anyhow, and Patreon, however you want to pronounce it, there's an account. You can go there. Matt, tell them the account, name so that people can find it.
It's patreon.com/rapids96podcast. And I assume if you go to whatever search browser they have and you search Holding the High Line or Rapids 96 podcast, we should come up at or near the top of that search.
And to sweeten the deal, so if you pledge either $5 or $5 a month, we will send you, as long as you give us an actual regular mail address, either via Patreon or over our DMs of Twitter or on the email, we'll send you two Holding the High Line stickers. If you pledge $30, that's a one-time, or if you stay subscribed to Patreon for a number of months at a couple bucks a month, if you spend $30 and send us your address, we will send you a Holding the High Line mug. I demoed the mug possibilities earlier this week and discovered, much to my chagrin and my shock, that people really liked the logo and they would buy that on a mug or on a sticker. They did not like a picture of your and my faces, Matt. And they did not want to wake up to coffee with our faces.
I think there's a reason, Mark, that this is an audio podcast and not a live YouTube feed or a YouTube video series that we have. And I'm definitely okay with the listener's decision on that, and I completely respect the fact that they don't want to see our faces first thing in the morning as they're trying to wake up with their morning Joe. They get enough of us. I don't think they should have to deal with us every single morning at 6:30 in the morning when they're trying to wake the kids up. And I will say, Mark, let's say that if somebody wants to give us $3 a month, then in theory, after 10 months, they get a mug. So it doesn't necessarily need to be $5 in one stint to get the sticker deal, nor $30 in one stint to get the coffee mug deal. And if you would like both after $35 in any order, feel free to DM us or email us. That'll be very easy for us to keep track of as far as both your payments via Patreon, and then also us documenting that, in the context of you getting, the swag that Mark is in the process of procuring.
I'm not good at math. There's no math in rabbinical school. So if you're going to do something crazy like pledge $1.73 and then hope that I figure out that at 8 months and 22 days I need to mail you a mug, that's not likely to happen. So my advice to you is just give us a nice simple amount of money and I will mail you a thing. And I will be very happy to do that. And I'm also, very glad and grateful to, Matt, you remember, the person who created the logo. Who is that?
That is, CR54 Designs on Twitter. He is a, graphic design major in college, and he is a Colorado Springs Switchbacks fan. He and I met through a mutual friend, Mark Turner, at a Switchbacks tailgate. He is also a Crystal Palace supporter. It's a younger kid. It's a college kid, obviously, and he's relatively anonymous on the internet, so I don't feel comfortable using his name without preference. But he's very, very close with Richard Terry and our various Denver-based Crystal Palace compatriots.
Well, anyhow, CR54, you've got a mug coming to you no matter what, so send me your email address, or your snail mail address, and I'll send that out to you. Props to you, and thank you guys all very much in advance for subscribing to our Patreon account. Keep this podcast going strong, and help us by kicking in a little bit of the cost for hosting.
And I will say that Mark and I have definitely, this has been kind of a learn as we go and experiment as we go. You know, it took us a couple episodes to figure out the format as far as good thing, bad thing, big thing, the approach to the selection and how we organize or go completely off the cuff with our banter topics has evolved. So this is definitely that we're, the Patreon and this concept is definitely something that we're wading into cautiously and kind of figuring out as we go. We just kind of wanted to see how much do listeners really care about the product that we have. I will say at this point, at no time, right now, are we considering making any of our content on the RSS feed that goes out to all the podcatchers where you listen to us. We're not planning on making that an exclusive thing to where you now have to pay to get that content. We're not looking at any exclusive Patreon-based content right now. That's something that we could be in discussion depending on how things end up going, feedback that we hear from you. We definitely are open to feedback in this process, but we're still planning on creating the podcast and not putting that through any kind of a paywall of sorts right now. Mark's done a really, really good job spearheading two ideas as far as swag to provide. In gratitude of those who want to subscribe to us on Patreon, we're open to experimenting and exploring that in the future. But, you know, these are definitely early days for us right now. Our Patreon situation is very much in preseason, Mark. And like Anthony Hudson and Pork Smith, you know, it's going to take us a while for us to figure out our roster and some of the tactical ideas. And it might be a little half-baked for a while before we actually figure things out. There is one other banter topic that I wanted to talk about, Mark, and conveniently you kind of created it when we had some discussion, you did on Twitter today.
Oh, I totally created it, dude. I did not kind of anything.
Okay. The concept of MLS teams creating their own in-house Spanish language content, whether that is a Spanish language Twitter account that they have. You know, I look at Los Rapids, for example. The LA Galaxy have, I believe it's L Galaxy. I could be or I think it might be Galaxy_ES for Espanol. But some teams have that. Some teams don't. Some teams involve it to varying extents. Some teams have a Spanish language broadcast, put out Spanish language content audio, video, written in variable quantities and in variable frequency and variable with varying success. And some of this will depend on the market to where maybe, you know, I might be stereotyping here. It's not that relevant for Minnesota United or for the Montreal Impact, though the Montreal Impact obviously have the French connection. So putting out French language content, whereas it's probably very, very relevant to the two Los Angeles based franchises, Orlando, Miami, when they get off the ground, certainly the two Texas teams. And you kind of talked about that in a general sense, how teams could go about going it. And in the context, we had an interesting banter back and forth at one point, Mark, about how the Rapids are approaching or not approaching, reaching out to the Spanish language community. What things did you talk about and what sort of thesis statements have you come up with, you know, while live thinking out loud earlier today on this topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of a broader, the broader piece that goes with all of this is the question of, have MLS teams reached out sufficiently to the Latino, Latinx, market? And the answer is, you know, it depends. And it's also a question of, where are your marketing dollars best spent? And that's like a broad, complicated question that it would take, you know, teams of business majors and marketing majors to kind of suss out. But my basic principle is the Latino market, really cares about soccer for various cultural, historical, and family reasons, in every market around the United States. And Major League Soccer should be marketing a lot to them. The league, I think, does a pretty good job, of creating and supporting Spanish language content. But, for each and every team in the league, it varies widely as to how much Spanish language content there is. Twitter's just one angle, to play. I mean, there's lots of different social media platforms, and it really varies from team to team about how much effort you put into your Spanish language programming, including Twitter. And it also varies team to team how much money and effort you put into marketing and advertising to any fan. So to that end, it was made aware to me semi-anonymously that the Philadelphia Union had not had a working Twitter account in almost 3 years. So I started to kind of go down the rabbit hole today of like, oh yeah, I wonder how many.
A working general Twitter account or Spanish language?
A working Spanish language Twitter account. So I went down the rabbit hole of looking at other MLS teams and seeing how many of them had a Spanish language Twitter account. And what I found was probably about half the teams in the league in the United States. I'm going to exclude Canada from this for semi-obvious reasons. Which is their Latino population tends to be smaller than the United States, although not necessarily so. But generally most teams either had a Twitter account and it fell dormant or have never had a Twitter account for their Spanish language. And that's not a great look. And then a few teams had one and have always had one. It's really interesting though. It's not necessarily what you would think. You would think that cities with larger Latino populations might have certainly a Spanish language account. That is not true. Houston has a very large Latino population and Houston Dynamo have never had a Spanish language Twitter account. Portland has a relatively small Latino population and it's always had, an account. Dallas does something really interesting. They tweet in Spanish about every 20th tweet from their main account, and they have no Spanish language one, but they produce more Spanish language content and video than most other teams. And then wealth is not a factor. So New York City FC, LAFC, and LA Galaxy are three of the richer teams in the league, and they all have Spanish Twitters. Meanwhile, the Red Bulls and Atlanta are two of the richer teams in the league. And also Atlanta has a huge Latino population. So does New Jersey and New York. And neither of those teams has a Spanish language Twitter. So it's very interesting. The last thing I'll say on this entire topic is I think it varies about how it depends on whether the team has someone who's in charge of social media and whether that social media person is bilingual. I know you and I, Matt, both know that the Rapids don't have a social media manager. They have people on the digital team who also manage the social accounts, but they don't have a person who just does social. It tends to be the upper 50% of MLS teams that have a person who just does social. The poorer teams, the lower 50% of teams, I think tend to have people who manage the accounts in addition to their other responsibilities. So I would say that the Rapids' lack of a Spanish language Twitter account the fact that they haven't tweeted from that account in over a year and a half is probably more of a factor of the team doesn't spend a lot of money on advertising and marketing with other teams, whereas it's not a direct snub to Latino fans. You know, TLDR, too long didn't read. My long thing is the Rapids aren't mistreating their Latino fan base. They mistreat their entire fan base equally. And that's my two cents on the topic. What do you think, Matt? Did I cover it pretty well? Are there any like kind of follow-up ideas or questions that you had off of this whole weird Twitter rabbit hole that I went down?
No, I think it's a really, really interesting concept. One thing that I think a lot of people, when I talk to non-MLS or non-soccer fans about MLS growing within the country or what they could do more, like the fact remains that as much as NBC has done a fantastic job of opening up access and content to the Bundesliga and to the game in England, and as much as ESPN Plus has opened up a whole bunch of other doors as far as watching the English Championship and Europa League and so many other leagues around the world, the fact is the most watched league in the United States as far as just world domestic leagues, excluding, you know, Champions League as its own thing, but just the domestic league itself, is still Liga MX in Spanish on the Univisions, the Unimases, etc., etc. And that's a population that MLS, frankly, has done a really, really poor job of trying to tap into as far as Spanish language-based content, as far as going off of players who those sorts of fans would be interested. You know, it took 10 years, really, for MLS to realize that South America was a market, and whether it's language, culturally, or just style of play, that's obviously, you know, something that appeals to the Hispanic, you know, to fans of Los Rapids, so to speak. And the LA Galaxy tried it, you know, when they brought in the Dos Santos, Jonathan Dos Santos and Giovanni Dos Santos, who's no longer with the team. I would say that LAFC's done a very, very good job as far as both the marketing of and the acquisition of Carlos Vela. You know, as Taylor Twellman dangled the carrot out there on one of the whichever national broadcast game he was on this past weekend, as far as like the next big get in terms of trying to tap into that market and that fan base and getting them interested in the league, is Chicharito Hernandez, who I think would be a slam dunk DP. It doesn't really matter where he is. He doesn't have to go into a market or a team that has a significant Hispanic population or a significant Hispanic fan base. Obviously, once that happens, I think then they would certainly want to wrap up their Spanish language content for people around the world, whether it's fans in Mexico, whether it's Mexican Americans in the United States, or even just having content to where Chicharito, who I can't remember offhand, I think he's done interviews in Spanish. I don't remember how good his English actually is, but just to make it easier for people to try and find his access. And that's an area that I think MLS has done a really, really poor job of trying to tap into. So many of these teams and the league as a whole has tried so hard to convert the Euro snob, where they've got a population that's right in front of them. And, you know, you've referenced a number of times, Mark, on this show, about, you know, the Rapids doing a really, really good job of, seeking non-native English speakers who live around Federal Boulevard, for example. And that's something that they absolutely could do a better job of. And this is off of maybe a question now that I have that I'm going to explore with, my various contacts. I have not seen the Spanish language radio team for the Colorado Rapids at any point at DSG Park in the calendar year 2019. I have not seen them at any of the three home games. And normally with how we had in our, before we went to, arranged seating at the end of last year and then now this season, I was pretty much set up right behind our good friend Estrella Pinedo, who doctored the nickname for, Enzo Martinez last year, El Vikingo. and I have not seen him or any or his producer or any of the people as far as their team. The only two squads that I've seen in the broadcast every single game have obviously been Richard Fleming and Marcelo Balboa, and then Connor Cape and usually Jordan Angeli, but a variety of casts that normally provide the English language commentary on Altitude Radio as his color commentary. And so I'm really curious to see why that is, if that team is no longer interested, if they're just doing it from a different location, not on site, if they're only doing it for road games or something. But I echo your point, Mark, that there is a population generally within MLS and definitely with the area codes 303 and 720 that the Rapids have not tapped into, and that is an untapped market that they could do a better job accessing. With that, Mark, shall we get to the events of this past weekend?
Let's talk about soccer.
So, listeners, this past Saturday at Dick's Sporting, not Dick's Sporting Goods Park, at Orlando City Stadium in Orlando, Florida, the Rapids played in a torrential downpour against the Purple and Gold Lions, and the Rapids were not victorious, losing by a score of 4-3. Anthony Hudson on paper deployed his men, Mark, in a 4-2-3-1 with Jack Price and Kellen Acosta in the main midfield, and Benny Philhaber for the first time starting in a true central attacking role. Kai Kamara was the first was the lone striker in this game, and he got on the board in the 9th minute after Kellen Acosta found Dylan Serna on the wing, who sent in a nice cross. It appeared to take a deflection off of a miscue from the back three from Orlando, and Kai Kamara tapped it in, did his heart hands, and then went full knee slide in the torrential rain and, you know, just skidded slowly to a halt. Nani gets the Lions on the board in the 35th minute after Ruan completely undresses Dylan Serna with a nutmeg near the touchline after blowing by him. The cross goes all the way across the box to Jean Moutinho, who sends the cross in, and Nani, 5'10", proceeds to dunk on Dylan Serna, who's listed at 5'7". I'm 5'6", and he's probably an inch shorter than me when I've stood next to him with him in cleats, Mark. So I'm going to call Dylan Serna 5'5". Rapids, whoever the people are who measure these heights, come at me. 2 minutes later, Orlando gets on the board off of a set piece for the Rapids. It is very poorly tracked back. Tesho Akindele scores off of a deflection. Really good job by Tim Howard, but he ends up leaving a rebound. Five or six Orlando players in the box, to just 4 field players for the Rapids on that one, 2 of whom were hanging back further than any Orlando players on the corner. We get to the second half. Nicholas Mesquita opens up his Rapids account in the 64th minute after some great ping passing from Kellen Acosta and Cole Bassett to find him. Kai Kamara running up the middle to occupy 2 of the 3 center backs on the back for Orlando, and Nicholas Mesquita has a thumping header that he runs onto completely unchallenged. Cole Bassett from Kenny Bellhaber in the 71st minute. Cole Bassett puts, you know, I'm going to call it, as opposed to fist pumping up, maybe 2 fists down, absolutely excited, and the Rapids are up 3-2 at that point, Mark, and then everything comes crumbling down. A couple minutes later, you have the incident that I'm sure we will talk about, involving Nani going down in the box with Kellen Acosta coming up behind him. Nani is incensed, has a few choice words that start with the letter F for the official, and then Kellen Acosta, they come together and their foreheads come into physical contact initiated by Nani. VAR appears to take a review, not entirely sure of what, because you can't be an away pool reporter asking questions. Substitute Chris Mueller scores off of a turnover in the 81st minute to make it 3-3. Then in the 87th minute, Axel Schuberg gets a hand on the inner part of his elbow off of a cross off a counterattack from Orlando. Nani steps up and takes the PK and scores, and the Rapids are still winless in 2019. Orlando City wins this game by a score of 4-3. Mark, where would you like to start with your good thing from this past Saturday's loss?
Oh my God. Well, man, there was a lot of offense, and the Rapids scored the first goal. Those are always really good things to see. It looked like Colorado was really controlling the game for long stretches, especially in the first half. The second half, including the 1 hour lightning delay, really kind of was almost a different kind of game. Mostly it was just really interesting to see Colorado, like, press its advantage and completely control the pace of things. And also, this was a thing. I was like typing it on Twitter at the same point as Marcelo Balboa said it out loud on the broadcast. But it really looked like Orlando were playing their 3 center backs really narrow. And they also weren't kind of getting their midfielders to cover in front. And so for the first 45 minutes, Colorado had
all the time in the world to push three guys forward. They did that thing where they bring their fullbacks up, and it really, really worked. So because they were able to use the width of the field by becoming as wide as the team could be with their fullbacks. So there were just a lot of really good things going on there early on in the attack. Mesquita getting a headed goal was really exciting to see. Cole Bassett's goal at the end with the cut and dribble back and then scoring with his left foot, it was all just wonderful to see. So there were a lot of good things, I suppose. Matt, what was your good thing?
You said the offense. I'll expound on that a little bit more. How many weeks in a row, Mark, have we talked about Kai Kamara just being completely starved of service, and simply if you get the ball to Kai Kamara and then provide support, good things will happen.
Right.
We've basically been talking about that all season. And guess what? This happened. This should not surprise you, dear listener. This should excite you. This should have been something that was obvious. Kai Kamara against the back three was regularly drawing double teams in a three-man back line as opposed to a two-man back line who were committed centrally, and only the opposing fullback, Ruan to the Rapids left and João Moutinho to the Rapids right as they go upfield. You got a 1v1 situation. And they got the ball forward into wide position, and then they lumped the ball into the box for Kai Kamara. Kai Kamara regularly drew a double team. In some cases, he beat that. In some cases, there was a secondary 50-50 ball that a Rapids player was able to get on. Ultimately, it was a deflection that allowed the first goal to happen. But Kai Kamara occupied space. He occupied opponents. And then that provided service to where something good was going to happen. Either Kai Kamara was going to win those battles, or if you provided support, you were going to win those battles as often as you were not. And where did they win those battles, Mark? Zone 14. This should not surprise you, listeners. This should not shock you. You should have seen this was going to happen and good things were going to happen. And the Rapids scored three goals. So profoundly obvious, so profoundly wonderful. It allowed Nicholas Mesquita to do things. Surprise. The Rapids have good enough attacking players to where if they put themselves in good position, allow Kai Kamara to occupy space, good things will happen and players will execute at things that they are good at. We saw that spectacularly in the second goal. Kellen Acosta as part of build-up play, who I thought had a decent game in a pure number eight role that I thought fit him really, really well. In terms of connecting things from the middle third and getting the ball going into the final third, Cole Bassett recognizes the situation. Kai Kamara runs up the middle, occupies two center backs. That creates a central channel that's wide open. Nicholas Mesquita goes into the space, unchallenged header, easy goal, beautiful goal. Formationally, we saw the Rapids in a 4-2-3-1. That at least that's what it was for the first 20 minutes. I hesitate to expound on the shape of a team when I'm not physically at the game, because with the camera angles and everything, you don't necessarily have the full field omniscient view, so you're only seeing a portion of it. So, you know, you're only getting to feel the trunk of the elephant, and then you're a blind mouse who thinks that it's a snake rather than getting to see the whole thing. But I thought at a lot of times it flattened out, but it was a solid 4-2-3-1. For the first 20 minutes, where the Rapids were hands down the better team. And we could say, you know, after the 25th minute, and then ultimately, you know, once we got to the 30th, bad things started to happen for the Pits. But they maintained that shape. That allowed Jack Price to be a pure central number six. That allowed them to have strength up the middle, because where previously in the diamond, in air quotes, they only had one committed demon. They had two players centrally who could commit themselves defensively and still maintain their overall shape. They had one guy centrally who was able to link up with Kai Kamara at times. That was often Nicholas Mesquita, sometimes Benny Fellhaber, but they also had support. And then for the first time, really all season, their fullbacks weren't on an island. Sometimes it was Kellen Acosta spraying out to the left. Sometimes it was Cole Bassett spraying out to the left. Dylan Serna had help on both sides of the ball at times. Obviously, he didn't have that for the first two goals to concede. And Keegan Rosenberry had support for the first time. I know the Rapids brought in a lot of players built on the 4-4-2 diamond, but this is something that I think might be worth exploring. And it was something that at least worked in terms of protecting some of the flaws the Rapids had and improving on some of the things that they had been struggling with that they needed to get better on. They just didn't maintain it, because then they took on pressure and they went into a flat 4-4-2, and Orlando did things that we've seen a lot of other teams do for the Rapids, due to the Rapids this year. On that note, Mark, where do you want to start with bad stuff?
I mean, it's really obvious. The bad stuff was the defense, which was bad. The two goals they gave up in rapid succession in the first half were pretty catastrophous. Is that a word?
Catastrophic is what you're thinking.
What?
Catastrophic?
I like catastrophous, though. I'm going to use that anyways. And then I don't remember which goal it was because there were that many. I mean, when you lose 4-3, you lose track of some of the things that happen. I think it was either the second goal or the third goal that Colorado conceded, but Colorado had a corner kick and they swung it in and then the ball bounced loose and then, Orlando raced back in the other direction and wound up with basically a free shot on goal with almost nobody to close down. And Ruan was the one who raced most of the way, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that would have been the second goal the Rapids conceded. Yeah. That would have made it 2-1 Orlando, and it would have been Dylan Serna on the header challenge off the corner and then ultimately losing the foot race with Ruan.
Yeah, good memory. I just rewatched. See, one of the challenges I have is that I was watching two games simultaneously. I was watching the Riverhounds game and the Rapids game, and then I just recapped the Riverhounds game. But anyways, I don't understand at all how this happens to teams. And having covered the Rapids for 6 years, like, I've seen Colorado concede after having a corner kick of their own, like, a ton of times. Like, I think I've seen it, like, at least 5 or 6 times, and it might even be more than 10. And on some level, I just don't understand how you allow that to happen as a coach and as a team. Like, you should have enough guys back centrally. For those of you who don't really understand how a corner kick works, I think most of you do, but I feel the need to, like, over-explain a little bit here, soccer-explain a little bit. Your best chance to score is with your tallest players. Typically, your tallest players are your strikers and your center backs. So that means you're going to take your center backs and you're going to put them in the box. The challenge of that is, the center backs are typically your best defenders. So now you don't have them in defense. You have them in the box. So you've got to put somebody else back on defense. Typically you put your two fullbacks kind of centrally farther back. Some teams are riskier on this and some teams are less risk averse. Some teams are risk averse and some teams are risky. That means that some teams will put two fullbacks back there. Some teams will put three players back there, or it'll be situational based on the score. And once in a while, like, you really want to score that goal, you just put one defender back there.
Or bring up the goalkeeper, which complicates things a lot as well.
Entirely crazy and really only something you would do in the 90th minute when you need the equalizer. Anyhow, point being, Colorado should have two guys back far enough. And also two players who know, including the person taking the corner, that, like, they're the first line of defense to get back. And so Colorado should have at least three players who are ready to chase back in the event that the ball bounces the wrong way. I watched the Hounds in the Pittsburgh Riverhounds in the exact same situation this week. And they had four guys back and they were able to chase down the opponent before anything bad happened on an almost identical play. Why Colorado wasn't set up that way, I don't know. I'd like to say that maybe it was bad luck, but this team has too much bad luck to blame everything on bad luck. Some of it's just poor planning and not being thoughtful about where you should be on a set piece, and not being ready in defense. And that's my big thing my bad thing, which is that the defense was full of problems, but very simply put, I don't see any reason or excuse why you should ever give up a goal when you have a corner on your side of the field.
I'm going to start with Dylan Serna on this one, Mark, and I feel like I've almost prophesized the situation that Anthony Hudson might be dealing with or thinking about or having to make a decision on this week as the Rapids have their first double game week, their first DGW of the 2019 season. Where I was impressed with what Dylan Serna was doing. I think he was learning what to do defensively from a left back and a left back on an island situation. he was doing a good job of helping to create offense every time that he got forward and providing service, taking shots on his own. And then he got victimized by Albert Elise. And Anthony Hudson just said it was purely an execution thing. And maybe secretly there was a master game plan that was going to provide support to where Serna wasn't going to be in those 1v1 situations, or he was going to be able to handle them better, or he had a little bit more help to where Lapanthera wasn't going to, due to the Rapids, what he ended up doing, getting involved in all four goals, two of them own goals for the Rapids, however. And in this one, he got posterized by Ruan on two separate occasions that ultimately allowed the first two goals to happen, and then he got subbed out, and Axel Schubert came in to really help with some of the aerial service that they were coming in to Dom Dwyer, to Nani, to Sasha Kljestan. And then Declan Wynn moved out to the left and was far more conservative going forward and definitely more focused on the defensive side rather than trying to overlap and help create offense. The Rapids had almost nothing going on from that left side in the second half, albeit the two goals that were ultimately conceded, one of them was a PK, and the other one came from mostly up the middle, maybe slightly to the Rapids' right, if I'm not mistaken. So, I wonder right now if Dylan Serna doesn't start either of these two games, we might be having the same conversation we had about him at right back last year, the same conversation we had at left midfield and right midfield in two separate instances under Pablo Mascherini, where he had a really good start, he had a couple really good moments, was finally about to turn the corner and put in a full 90-minute performance on both sides of the ball, and then just has two massive howlers that end up costing the Rapids, to where you could say on an individual basis, he was the one who lost his 1v1 matchup with the Houston Dynamo last home game that ultimately cost the team the game, and they were out of it by the 30th minute. And you could argue that the Rapids were in a great position going into the opening 20 minutes, and he makes two mistakes and they're immediately punished with goals. And okay, Serna 1v1 probably isn't the best left back in MLS, but how he didn't know that, how Hudson kind of saw that coming and talked about how we had a game plan for that, we weren't going to let that happen again, how it happened again, and how particularly his teammates are seeing that and knowing that and just kind of trusting that eventually he'll figure out instead of providing support. He gets nutmegged on the first goal and everything, but then nobody was over there to help him. Ruan was able to run on goal and fire that cross, and I don't fault Serna at all for losing that header challenge against Nani. He's 4 inches shorter than him, and Tim Howard could have challenged for that ball. Kofi Opare, who's I think well over 6 feet, could have challenged for that ball, but Serna's just been ripped up, and some of that is systematic. I think some of that is him, and I just think whether it's seeing this before, whether it's seeing the track record with him, if Serna doesn't get any minutes in these next two games, I think Serna might be relegated to the bench, and I seriously wonder at that point what future, if any, he has with the Colorado Rapids going forward, given just how many times we've seen this. And I mean, there aren't that many positions left for him to get an opportunity at where there's zero competition, have a couple good moments, and then have the bottom completely fall out and then not be seen again for another 6 months. With that, Mark, let's move on to Big Thing.
Big Thing. I guess Big Thing for me is about belief and luck. And I typically don't delve into such non-statistical, non-tactical things like belief and luck. But it's very hard to watch a team under Anthony Hudson struggle week after week after week and not wonder, especially in a week like this, where Colorado was at least equal to their opponent, was very talented, was tactically prepared.
Had a good start for the first time.
They did really well. They played very, very well throughout the game, and then they just kind of like fall apart at all these ridiculous boneheaded moments, and it's just these little tiny errors that keep creeping in, like Dylan Serna getting nutmegged, like not getting back on a corner kick and realizing that the opposer is a threat, like Jack Price not really covering ground defensively to seal off the midfield, Tim Howard tipping a ball right back into traffic instead of blocking it clear, which is a thing that we've seen before. I mean, it is very hard to get a clean punch when you're really just trying to bat a ball away. But like Tim Howard's not pushing balls far enough out of the 6-yard box and out of the 18. He's giving opponents rebounds. Like So for all of that, I mean, all of those are small things that are about talent and skill, but they're also about little mental errors and not having killer instinct. Like, the team looked like they were up, and then they didn't really know what to do with themselves with the lead. And then they were up again with the lead when it was 3-2, and they didn't know what to do with themselves. Like, they don't have the focus, the wherewithal, the killer instinct, the confidence right now to say, we are winning, we are going to win no matter what it takes. And that's kind of like ethereal, and it lacks a certain amount of like intellectualism that I usually bring to soccer. But like, this team doesn't believe in itself right now. The players don't believe in themselves. They mostly lose. They've mostly been losing for 2.5 years. I think they get into a situation where they have a lead on the road and they go, oh, I really hope we don't screw this up. Instead of saying, let's cut the head off the snake. Let's just finish this sucker.
Let's stop the bleeding, since that was one of Anthony Hudson's mannerisms. I've got two big things I want to talk about, Mark. First, we will get to this and ask HCHL, but the officiating. I didn't get a really good angle on it live, and I thought maybe it was a little bit more equal in terms of the incident with Nani on the PK shout. I want to say maybe 74th, 75th minute. It was after the Rapids took the lead, but prior to Chris Mueller coming on and scoring to tie the game at 3-3. Orlando's building onto the back, getting the ball moving really, really quickly. Ball comes to Nani, who, in my opinion, from the angle, was already going down. When the ball was coming to him, might have been contact after the fact from Kellen Acosta. Nani flops to the ground, puts his head, like, completely flabbergasted that the official did not give him the PK. Steps up, confronts the referee, gets into it with Kellen Acosta. Acosta chooses to stand, in my view, from what I've seen, stand his ground, but not move forward. Nani initiates the contact with the head, sort of a head bump, or at least a forehead boop, if nothing else. And Acosta stands his ground and doesn't try to stand off it. You know, it's like, I'm here, I'm gonna hold my ground. I'm not gonna advance, but I'm not gonna take this from a guy who, in my opinion, completely dove. Like, I'm gonna stand up for myself and stand up for my teammates. Dom Dwyer and Tim Howard get involved in that. Incidentally, go for the opponent, whereas I think it probably would have been healthier for Tim Howard to just straight up pick Kellen Acosta up and move him away, and Dom Dwyer equivalently for Nani as well. The play is halted. The official has his hand to the microphone in his earpiece that I presume was potentially looking at it, whether or not it was looking at whether or not it was a PK or possibly giving Nani a red card. We've seen MLS pretty cut and dry. You initiate contact to the head, even with your own head. We saw it with Nicky Jackson in the first red card of the 6-0 against RSL last year, and he was given a red card for, you know, what might have been, you know, maybe 20 or 30 total skin cells contacting in the forehead area between Nicky Jackson and Albert Rusnak, and nothing was ultimately called. I would argue you could have even given a yellow card to Nani just for simulation. We saw Diego Rubio get that a couple of games ago, or you could have given him a yellow card for referee abuse when he had a pretty, you know, I'd say a 15-20 second tirade with several four-letter words at the official, and I thought the official could have stood up for himself and, you know, nipped the head in the bud right there, and that didn't happen. And based on precedent, I thought that was a poor decision by the officials. And as we get to, I think some of the conspiracy theory or the catastrophizing from Rapids fans is not unfounded. Last thing I'll say, as much as we saw the midfield support the offense, we saw them equally as delinquent as they have been in supporting the defense. They're, you know, Jack Price and Kellen Acosta were both late arriving on the Teshua Kandeli goal. You know, this team has to know by now that defense is their weakness, that their center backs, any of them really, other than Kofi Opare, you know, who we've only seen for one game, are going to make mistakes that are going to put the Rapids in a position to allow goals, and nobody's really self-corrected. Maybe that's execution, maybe that's planning in the game plan, but the Rapids are openly leaving a weakness that other teams are exploiting. And I think, as much as fans have been lamenting, you know, I hate this in hockey, Mark, where the, you know, the hot takey fan, particularly the one who I would consider uneducated, looks at the box score and say, you know, let's say the Avalanche end up losing the game 5-2, and all they want to do is blame the goalie. It's all the goalie's fault. Maybe if it ends up being a couple power play goals for the opponent, they blame the, you know, whoever it was who was ultimately taking the penalties, but they don't look at the system in of itself and say, you know, okay, well, Varlamov gave up 5 goals. You know, how many of them were one-timers where he didn't have enough support challenging the shot, or how many of them were on breakaways that are pretty 50-50 as far as the NHL goals? And I think a lot of the fans who are just looking, we scored 3 on the road, the offense is fine, we allowed 4 on the road, that was bad, it's all the center backs, get rid of Tim Howard, change the 4 defenders, and we'll be fine. You're not seeing the forest through the trees. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, I'm not sure that the Rapids have better options at this point other than Court 4 getting healthy, who's still probably at least 2 weeks away. And so we know what Tommy Smith is. We know what Danny Wilson is. We know what all of these guys are, and they're just not very good. I don't see how shuffling the lineup between who is starting and not starting is going to change things, and I don't know how much room they have to go out and sign somebody new at this point. That's going to have to be something to address in the summer, but, you know, knowing that weakness, knowing that that's not getting any better, something else in the cog in the machine has to change. And for me, that's midfield support, and it hasn't been there all year in any shape, any formation, and any personnel. Let's move on, Mark. We are currently 6-34 through the 2019 Colorado Rapids regular season. That reduces down to 3-17, and the Rapids are worse than they are in the standings than they were last week when San Jose Earthquake got a win over the Portland Timbers this past weekend. So, in the Western Conference, the Rapids are sitting in 10th out of 12 teams. They have 2 points off of 6 games played. That's 4 losses and 2 draws, and they have a -7 goal differential. The Rapids have 2 games this coming week. Both of them will be at Dick's Sporting Goods Park at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on their respective days. They'll be playing the Seattle Sounders, who are 2nd in the Western Conference, 13 points off of 5 games played. That's 4 wins and 1 tie with a +8 goal differential. And then this coming Saturday, they'll be welcoming DC United and Wayne Rooney for the first and possibly only time to Dick's Sporting Goods Park. DC United currently 3rd in the Eastern Conference, 10 points off of 4 games played, 3 wins, or no, excuse me, I'm looking at the wrong column, 10 points off of 5 games played. They are 3-1-1 with the lone loss coming this past weekend to LAFC, a 4-0 drubbing that saw Wayne Rooney sent off. DC United plays tomorrow, Tuesday the 9th, against Montreal Impact, so Wayne Rooney will be suspended for that game and presumably be on a full week's rest and available for selection on Saturday. So any Manchester United fans or Everton fans who are really excited to see Rooney, you will still get to see him. This will not be a Zlatan situation like last year. Mark, let's start with the Seattle Sounders. We've talked about this team already. Not a whole lot has changed with them other than Raul Ruiz Diaz being held out this past Saturday due to an injury. Seattle's a very, very good team. They're a stacked team. They do a lot of things well, and they're really, really good building up through that left side. What do you see in this game, and what do the Rapids need to do differently than they did at the Clink to try and get a result on hump day?
Well, simply put, they can't give up the goal early. That was really what hurt them in Seattle, although Seattle thumped them thoroughly from beginning to end. I think the game ended, what, 4-1, right?
Against Seattle? No, yeah. It was 2-0.
2-0. God, it felt like 4-1. The simple thing is that the overlap on the left side from Seattle, not only did the Rapids get burned by it over and over again with Brad Smith, Victor Rodriguez,
Nico Lodero, take your pick.
Yeah, Raul Diaz. Like, everybody over on that left side was just clowning. That's been a thing that after I mentioned it in Backpass on the Denver Post, the next week and the week after that, I read about it in other newspapers. I heard about it on one of our other favorite podcasts, Extra Time, that everybody's noticing that they do this with this overlap on the left. You have to be able to shut down that overlap on the left without giving up anything else in the middle or on the right. The danger of dealing with an overwhelming force in terms of numbers on one side is that you're going to get pulled out of shape on your far side, and you're going to open yourself up for a back post, across to the back post, and you'll be undefended because you've moved your right back too far over sorry, your left back too far over to the other side. So that's kind of the thing that Colorado has to figure out. They have to figure out how to be able to stop attacks down the sides while not getting pulled out of position. And they also have to figure out, how to generate enough attack without giving up too much defense. Right now, I think they're pushing too many players up into the attack, and they need to figure out how to leave somebody behind. And whoever is left behind in the midfield needs to be capable of getting out and defending. So sometimes the Rapids leave two players back. But sometimes when they do that, they bring up both fullbacks, which means they're vulnerable in wide areas. So everything is kind of like interconnected and interdependent. And it feels like Colorado has not figured out how to let go of A without dropping B. Like every piece gets pulled out of position and it leads to this castigating set of failures. Last thought, Matt, this is kind of related back to a thing that I keep seeing on Twitter and people complain about it. And you mentioned it in talking about Orlando, which is that like a lot of people are critical of the Rapids back four. They just think that there's something wrong defensively at center back or at right back or at left back, and that's what's going on. I think most of the problems, especially in Orlando, but even going back a game or two before that, they come out of midfield. Like there's not a lot of midfield support, and you're leaving defenders in these one-on-one or 1v2 situations where you can't really expect them to stop that play. It goes back to something that Fran Taylor told me last season when I interviewed him, when he was talking about like tactical analysis, which is when he would go back and look at something that happened with a defender. When he was at Arsenal, they would look a step back and say, like, well, why is that defender in that position where he's the last man, or where he shifted, you know, 5 feet too far to the left to make the play? And usually it's because he was left for dead by his midfield. Like the midfield did something wrong, and now the defender's in a bad spot to stop it. And I'm a big fan of that. I do think that the defense, the back four, haven't been great, but I also feel like, if Colorado can just get a little bit more pressure from their midfielders on their defense, and if they can look less like they're trying to emergency defend at the last second in wide areas and even in the middle, that would be a huge benefit going into this game. So unfortunately, I didn't say anything specific to Seattle. I feel like Colorado's problems are fairly unique to how they're attacking right now and how they're defending. What do you think, Matt? What do you see in Seattle from the last game that needs to be corrected, or what are some things that you're most worried about going into this game?
First thing, I agree with your sentiment on people blaming the defense, and that's really, that's people looking at the symptoms and not the actual causes. I agree with you that I think a lot of what Seattle's going to be doing is going to be down the Rapids' right-hand side, and this is an excellent opportunity and an exercise where we've seen the last couple games they've left out Dylan Serna out to dry defensively, and can they, whatever they've been trying that hasn't been working, can they try that or improve upon it or do something different that will work on the right-hand side to help protect Keegan Rosenberry? I think in this game, Rosenberry is going to have to be a lot less offensively minded, so he's not caught up Smith. You know, he did not win the 1v1 just dueling situation in terms of his positional matchup against Brad Smith, who's an excellent outside back. I believe he's still on loan from AFC Bournemouth, but he said that he wants to come to the Sounders long term. You know, the Sounders have a really long history of really, really good fullbacks, going back to DeAndre Yedlin. And obviously they've got Kevin Leerdam on the other side. So Keegan Rosenberry's gonna have to be very aware. He's gonna need some support. And in Seattle working down their left-hand side, the opponent's right, you see a lot of late trailing runs from the other side that ultimately gets on the end of the run. You'll remember it was Kevin Leerdam, the Sounders right back, who scored on the first goal for Seattle. That was a textbook situation of what we were talking about. They obviously have Jordan Morris there on the right-hand side, who has a deadly right foot, not so much on the left. So I think the Rapids are going to have to be focused on prevention on their right side defensively, and in transition, they're going to have to focus on maintenance and management on their left-hand side. So can they do something such that Brad Smith only gets three or four chances instead of six or seven in overlapping? And when those situations do happen, whether it's Kellen Acosta or Cole Bassett, whoever that left midfield player is, don't get caught upfield and make sure that somebody is picking up Jordan Morris. And whether it's Dylan Serna or Declan Wynn or possibly even Sebastian Anderson, know where the late arriving Kevin Leerdam is. If they're more prepared on that end, they will snuff out those situations before they happen, and they'll be more prepared to emergency defend to prevent them from happening as well. Offensively, I think it's a really, really simple situation. Force old man dad Chad Marshall into as many aerial duels as you can from Kai Kamara and get support in there with guys who are faster than Gustav Svensson to try and create havoc for Stefan Frey. I think that's the only way they're going to create stuff offensively, but I think the bigger issues for the Rapids right now, especially in the context of the opponent, are on the defensive side of the ball. Let's move on to this coming Saturday, Mark, where the Rapids will be taking on DC United. Four-time MLS Cup champions. It's the first time that we'll be seeing them at Dick's Sporting Goods Park in 2 years. The last time, I believe, was the MLS debut for Paul Areola, and the team has changed significantly. Since then, Steve Birnbaum is their absolute rock in defense. Bill Hamid is back after a brief and very unsuccessful stint, I believe, in Denmark, question mark. Brilliant is their other main center back that they have. They've got a completely new midfield other than Kellen Acosta. Lucas Rodriguez, who's got the blonde hair, who had a fantastic finish to open his account in the blowout against RSL about a month ago, is their replacement for, who was the guy who they had who was at Atlanta and then he came to DC United, and now he's not in MLS anymore. Yamil Assad. So yep. Lucas Rodriguez is their tan replacement for Yamil Assad from Buenos Aires. Russell Knaus, who, in my opinion, is getting snubbed as far as a legitimate backup holding midfield, pure number six role for the midfield. And then Junior Moreno is their other big acquisition that they have. Wayne Rooney will be in this game. As we talked about earlier, he is suspended for the earlier match. This is a very good team, Mark, despite what LAFC did to them. They're very good defensively out of the back, and they have possibly the best link-up connection in MLS right now in the form of Luciano Acosta and Wayne Rooney, nicknamed Lucharoo. What do you see in DC United as a team under Ben Olsen, and what do you see particularly in this game, as this will be the first time, I believe, that Wayne Rooney will be playing at altitude in MLS?
Ben Olsen had a reputation in his first couple of years with DC as a pretty dire coach, kind of Pablo Mastroeni of the East. Very defensive, very physical, wanted to win 1-0, and did not play fun soccer. So kick it long, defend for your life mostly. And he's actually changed a lot, in the Lucharoo world. You know, when he got Lucho Acosta, he figured out how to use him in an attacking way. Although it took a little while because Acosta would often play outside. And now he's playing either more centrally or he cuts in more often. And then adding Rooney to the mix meant that you could send really nice little through balls, or you could play little 1-2s that were, they created a lot of mismatches and problems for opposing teams. So, you see a lot of that. You see Russell Knaus playing deep and protecting both of them while also being capable of getting into the attack and sending balls through. You know, there's a lot really going on there, and it's a lot of fun to watch. And then there, one last thing is that I think this last week they had a goal off of Steve Birnbaum corner kick and header. Birnbaum's a really talented central defender, and he will create mismatches and problems for you also. So that's a lot, you know, that's a lot going on. The one thing I think you can expect out of DC is that they will struggle at altitude. It's been a while since I even mentioned, the advantage that the Rapids have with altitude, because typically they haven't taken advantage of it, but, DC United are, I mean, with a guy like Wayne Rooney, he's really not ready for altitude. So that's going to be something of an issue, for him. It's kind of exciting that, Colorado will get to see Wayne Rooney,
As you mentioned before, he's been suspended, but that's for a match on Tuesday. So God willing, and the disco and health willing, Wayne Rooney will make his first ever appearance in Colorado. That being said, I think last year we were hoping for Zlatan and we didn't get Zlatan because he was out, with some sort of small injury. I remember a couple of years ago, I was all excited for the Galaxy to bring out Landon Donovan, and Donovan didn't play that game. I feel like the big stars often don't wind up playing in Colorado. So I've got my fingers crossed. If there's anything to say about this game, I've got my fingers crossed that you will get to hang out with Wayne Rooney, Matt, and the top.
Hopefully. I see a lot of similarities between the two Rapids opponents for this week, Mark. Both mostly deploy in a 4-2-3-1. They've got active fullbacks, I would say more active and more aggressive on Seattle's side. They've got a solid holding midfielder partnering Gustav Svensson and Christian Roldan for the Sounders, Russell Knauss and Junior Moreno for DC United. They both got probably a top 5 number 10 in MLS who likes to roam, can create stuff for himself or for somebody else, Nico Lodero for the Sounders. Luciano Acosta for DC United, and then that number 10 normally has a borderline psychic connection with his main number 9. I think, you know, if the Rapids are able to get lucky and Raul Ruiz Diaz isn't going to be able to start on Saturday, on Wednesday, I think they'll be in a much better situation to deal with the overload that Seattle is doing after they get the ball down that left flank and then whip across into the box. They're not going to have that on Saturday, I think especially since he is suspended, that, you know, Wayne Rooney's gonna have a full level of rest. He's gonna be fully prepared. He doesn't have to worry about playing on Tuesday. I don't know that Wayne Rooney's gonna start and play a full 90 minutes, but I wouldn't be shocked at all if he starts and goes a solid 70 and looks as good in those 70 minutes as we've seen him be able to play 90 minutes full, at Audi Field in the District of Columbia. So this is going to be, if nothing else, two really good exercises against similar teams, where I think the Rapids, every single week, they've seen something different. And, you know, Anthony Hudson has had to maybe scrap the complete game plan based on the quality of the opponent and how they play and based on what things didn't work last week and what he's building on. These are two really, really similar teams to where you're almost going to get one iteration where I presume the Rapids had Sunday off because that's normally what they do, and that might have been a travel day with such a late game on Saturday night. You know, I assume, you know, they had practice today, they'll have a light training tomorrow, and anything that does or doesn't work on Wednesday, they'll be able to address, tweak, possibly have a second iteration of on Thursday and Friday, and maybe be a little bit better against, I would argue, a better opponent, if nothing else, because you've got a guaranteed number 9 who's going to be starting, they're both as deadly as they are, but, you know, if Raul Ruiz Diaz isn't 100%, you know, I'd expect Rooney to be more prepared, than Ruiz Diaz to be. I don't think you're gonna see as active fullback overloads, but I think you're gonna see a stronger midfield. You know, I think the midfield 5 that DC has absolutely stacked at every single position, and that is going to be a tremendous challenge, especially on the defensive side of the ball that we've seen from the Rapids, who we're looking at are probably gonna be outnumbered and aren't going to be as good. So, Jack Price is going to have a really big challenge with both of the number 10s this week. I think whether it's the overloads, that's going to be an excellent opportunity and a challenge for Kellen Acosta and Cole Bassett. And whoever's playing at the number 10 role is going to have their hands full as far as very physical, very athletic, very mobile holding midfielders. You know, this is going to be a really good test for the Rapids. If they get absolutely whomped in this game, Mark, I think the conversations that we were having in the middle of June last year, we're probably going to have going up into the game against Vancouver, as I've tweeted and written about. You know, they've got a home game coming up against Vancouver, a road game coming up against Chicago. If those aren't positive results, we could be looking at potentially a winless Rapids team going into the month of June. We've already talked about the schedule that they're going to have basically from the middle of August on, Mark. You know, if the Rapids need to figure it out, and, you know, it's only going to get tougher from here as far as the quality of opponent. I'd absolutely take 2 points out of this entire week. If they're able to somehow get a win, I think that could be a massive monkey off the back for Anthony Hudson and a number of the players who are taking a lot of heat and criticism from the fans, pundits, etc.
You know who else we didn't mention, which is kind of amazing? We didn't mention Paul Arriola, who,
oh my god,
right? He's which is kind of ridiculous. U.S. men's national team wide midfielder. I think he predominantly plays on the right side, right?
Yes, he's normally a right midfielder, and there have been times, though I don't think this year just with how good Jara has been for the team, where he's also been deployed as a right back to then allow them to bring in, I want to say it's either Stiebert or maybe Chris Durkin into the midfield as well. And then Areola just Areola does all of the things that Rapids fans have dreamed of Dylan Serna doing from the right back position as a normally winger midfielder attacking option.
Yeah, I mean, he's you know, that's how good DC is, that we could spend almost 5 minutes talking about them and just completely forget about a U.S. men's national team starter that's on.
We haven't talked about Bill Hamid other than me mentioning that he exists. And he might be the goalkeeper of the year right now.
Sometimes. I mean, he'll have a brain fart or two midseason that will concede a goal or do something silly, but like usually. But I'm always a big fan of Bill Hamid. So that's how stacked this team is. They're just very deep and very talented. And yeah, I think one of the things that made me think of that, Matt, was your comments that like what happens to the Rapids if they lose both these games and they lose them in convincing fashion? Like, where are we at? And I think honestly, it's a realistic likelihood that they lose both of these games. That these are two of the best teams in Major League Soccer, and they're on a tear right now, and they're laying teams to waste. And Colorado are still trying to fumble around and find their keys to start the car. You know, like it's just really, I think they get a point out of one of these two games, but I wouldn't be surprised if they dropped them both.
I'll take a draw against Seattle, maybe a 1-1 game in that one, Mark, but I think definitely, especially with DC playing midweek, but then they play on Tuesday against the Montreal Impact, who are no giants in of their own kind. Though they did get a really impressive draw against New York City FC on a carpet postage stamp at Yankee Stadium after getting a red card. So, but you know, they'll be on an extra day's rest. I presume they'll be out here relatively early. So I'll take 1 point in this one, Mark. But I mean, if they get shellacked, you know, let's say they lose both games, and let's say the goal differential is maybe 4 or 5. I think at that point, realistically, we're looking at, you know, if the Rapids are, you know, are in a cafeteria hall, you know, in high school, I think we're looking at New England Revolution and the San Jose Earthquakes, you know, pulling up a chair for them to be joined at the wooden spoon table. I think if the Rapids get no points and lose convincingly and, you know, catastrophically this week in both of these games, I think we're seriously talking about this team as a contender for the 2019 wooden spoon, which, you know, we talked about last season being the most disappointing season in Rapids history. I think to do that, it would be even worse than what happened in 2018. Okay, Mark, official predictions. Are we going to say 1 point for the Rapids this week?
Put me down for 1 point.
are we in agreement that it will be the Seattle game that is the draw?
I don't know. Last week I was so incredibly specific with scores and so on that this week I'm just going to punt and say we're getting a point. I don't know where.
Okay, let's move on to Ask HDHL, Mark. We've got two really good questions. The first one comes from Ben E., I believe a first-time Ask HDHLer, and Ben asks, Mark, what can be done to improve the defensive shape? This was in response to the tweet that we had, me being a little bit of a troll saying that, you know, sarcastically that Rapids fans are calm and don't want to throw furniture out of windows. Mark, what can the Rapids do to improve the defensive shape?
There's a couple different ways of doing it. One is, and this is a thing that we've seen in the past, but we've done less of this season. It's fairly common that if you're going to come up with a fullback with the ball in attack, so let's say Dylan Serna is bringing the ball up the field on the left side, or let's say somebody's coming up the left side and Dylan Serna is off the ball and coming up in attack to overlap, you leave Keegan Rosenberry back at right back. You leave him deep in order to defend, and you've got basically three defenders kind of on the back line, kind of even. Colorado hasn't done that this year. They've mostly crept up both sidelines with both fullbacks, which means you're relying on both of your center backs to take on the weight of any potential sudden counterattack that happens. That's one possibility. Another one is a thing that we saw last year tactically, which you can do very easily. It didn't really help that much last year. It just really depends on how well the midfielders are playing as a unit, which is you have your deepest midfielder kind of drop right into the middle
of the two center backs and be like a third center back. That means that you have somebody like Jack Price or Benny Fellhaber be ready to drop right onto that line and be like, you know, potentially, you know, a third center back, or if you're bunkered deep and you're really trying to stop things, it could be like a fifth center back. So those are some shape issues that Colorado could toy with. And the most simple one would just be to kind of, when they are ahead, drop into a straightforward, fairly simple 4-2-3-1. That once when Colorado has a late lead, like they did in Orlando, they need to try and protect that lead by changing their shape a little, by having two kind of defensive midfielder type players. I think one of the challenges Colorado has right now is that they haven't figured out personnel-wise who are their two best deep-lying midfielders. Kellen Acosta did it a little bit in Orlando, and I thought he looked really good doing that. He was very physical, very harassing, as you can tell from the Nani
kind of reaction
change, right? But I liked the way Kellen Acosta played in this game. I thought it was one of his best games of the season, mostly defensively, but he plays deep pretty well. Fellhaber doesn't cover the ground as much as he used to, and he sometimes will be up in attack and then make a bad play trying to get back in defense. Cole Bassett just isn't ruthless and reckless enough, I think, to play defensive mid, although he's played deep a little bit this year. Nicholas Mesquita just doesn't have the chops altogether, and I don't know about Jack Price. Jack Price has been, I don't know, underwhelming all year so far, and he's just not doing a whole lot of anything, which blows me away. So I don't know. I mean, that's the question. It's like, I think the person who wrote in had a great question of like, how do we change the shape to get the defense better? And I think I have some suggestions, but at the end of the day, we also need defensively minded midfielders to step up and shift their focus away from scoring and towards stopping.
I'll take the last guest CHL we have for tonight, Mark. This one comes from Purple Rocks. Purple Rocks asks, in regards to Acosta's comment about lack of a card for the headbutt, do the Rapids just not earn calls? Jackson gets sent off for less than that last year against RSL. Again, referring to the headbutt against Albert Rusnak. The Kellen Acosta tweet, if you have not seen it, he sent out yesterday, comical, and then it's the emoji with like the laughing, but then the tears, like, so laughing so hard you're crying. So comical, a dive and two headbutts, hashtag no card, and I get told to blankety blank. Acosta, censored himself as well, but it's obvious what he's talking about, before I get carded. So told me to shut up, before I get carded. Something has to change, .. Hashtag, where is my protection? Orlando fans were being absolute trolls in that situation. You know, I already said earlier, Mark, do you agree that it, based on precedent, that should have been a red card on Nani?
It's a really, for the headbutt? It's a really tough call. I think it's kind of dumb. We're all arguing about how the rule is applied, and very simply put, to the letter of the law, no, it's not a red card for a stupid reason, which is that he didn't make contact. But that's stupid because, you know, if I do something really, really dangerous that could really, really hurt someone.
If you try to punch me in the face and miss, yes, does the intent of violent conduct not matter?
I should be punished, right? And so Nani seemed to have been attempting to headbutt, but somehow it didn't come off. I don't understand it. I don't think anyone in their right mind would complain if he had drawn a red card there, but to the letter of the law, no, he didn't deserve a red card.
Okay, but I would say based on precedent, we have an MLS where we've seen much, much less, much, much more incidental, and certainly not with the referee looking right at it directly, get a straight red card even without having to go to bar. If I'm trying to make sense of what the official was looking at, maybe he saw, you know, it was a back and forth emotionally charged game and both of the players were kind of getting involved, you know, maybe from the angle that he had initially, he thought that both were trying to go for it rather than, you know, a player just sitting aimlessly looking away and then somebody coming in and headbutting them out of nowhere, you know, lighting them up like a linebacker on a completely unsuspecting slot receiver. Maybe that was something they were looking at, or maybe they just thought, you know, again, this was an emotionally charged game. Nani didn't have a call go his way, you know, just let him let that emotion out, and the referee trying to manage the situation rather than do something that was going to change the result. I'm not saying that that would have been my thought process in that situation. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just trying to make sense of maybe what the official was thinking that ultimately led the decision to give nobody a card, because they could have looked at it and called it a penalty. Nani could have gotten a yellow card for referee abuse or for simulation. He could have gotten a red card for headbutt. You could have just diffused the situation, just said, I'm giving you both a yellow card. Everybody knock it off, or whoever initiates it next is getting sent off. We see that all the time in hockey where there's sort of a scrum and it's kind of unclear who starts it or who's more at fault. So the referee just ultimately gives two guys a penalty and says, somebody do that next time. Only one's going to go. And then nobody tries to do it because nobody wants to get unfairly punished and get a penalty against them. I think if Drew Fisher, I believe it was, ends up giving two yellow cards and says, anytime one of you starts something with each other or somebody else, I'm giving you a second yellow. Kellen Acosta is going to mind his P's and Q's the rest of the game. Nani's kind of crazy as it is, so who knows what he does, you know, hashtag team chaos. To Purple Rocks' point, Mark, I have heard some things off the record that I have hesitated to mention in any of my platforms regarding the official approaches, especially post-VAR, regarding the Colorado Rapids. Anthony Hudson and other members of the club have been critical of the officials at times, giving examples where maybe they don't get calls that other teams get, or, you know, if Nani, you know, if a Rapids player does what Nani does and gets a red card, then the only questions Hudson's getting from me in the media, in the post game is about discipline and what's going wrong and how he's going to deal with that and all this stuff. But obviously the only thing anybody wanted to talk about with the Orlando press was about them finally getting a win and Nani getting a brace that ultimately saw the result through. And I have heard some things in connecting the dots that would suggest that officials in MLS are still bitter about some of the borderline referee abuse they got in the Pablo Mastroianni era, both from players, from members of the coaching staff, both Mastroianni and other members, and in particularly excessive amount of profanity.
Wow.
I have hesitated to bring this up in any public platform or put this out for public consumption in any of my content. I feel that criticizing the refs is a very hot takey, you know, easy cop out for a lot of people to use, both fans and pundits, and oftentimes fans. And this isn't Rapid specific or Denver specific. I could say this about every single fan base. Go look at Atlanta anytime they don't get a PK call and are crying, you know, bloody murder about that. But then, you know, they get the crazy situation with the road game at San Jose, where San Jose has a handball, but then they score 2 minutes later, and like 5 minutes of play happens before ultimately Jose Martinez makes it 1-0 when it should have been 1-0 the other way. And I feel like every fan ultimately has those colored glasses on, where sure, every time a call doesn't go their way, or it seems slightly unfair, or it's 50-50 and they don't get it, they cry bloody murder with the officials. But anytime something goes their way, they look the other way, or they're okay with it, or they don't criticize the official, or they don't compliment the ref when the ref makes a fair call, whether or not it goes in their favor, or something by the letter of the law. But I think this is happening too frequently, and with what I've heard, possibly that there's a culture or a reputation or something. I don't know offhand if maybe Hudson is continuing some of the actions that happened under the Mastroianni era that is causing officials to still have that. But I would, in hindsight, looking back at it last year, particularly during the losing streak, where Hudson commented on the officials and not getting calls and things particularly going against them, and possibly other teams getting the benefit of the doubt where lowly Colorado Rapids weren't, I'm seeing enough of a trend to where I don't think that that's merely or a coincidence, or that something, I don't even know how I would do this from a media standpoint. Maybe it's Howard Webb. Maybe it's just being more nice to the officials. Maybe it's not using any profanity towards them, to where that's not nothing. And it could be based in some precedent elsewhere, to where I do think that fans have a right to be upset with Nani not getting a red card. And I think if we see something similar, especially if there's precedent for a Rapids player doing something and getting punishment, that they do have a right to gripe about that. And in that, I think fans have a right to be upset it was still 3-2 that, you know, ultimately the officiating undid the Rapids, and things could have worked out differently if teams were in different colors. Maybe it's because it's Nani and he's a DP. Maybe it's because it was, you know, a controversial call and the officials just wanted to let him get the situation out. Maybe it's because it was a guy who played for Manchester United, you know, fairly or unfairly, you know, Sam Cronin isn't getting the same treatment that, you know, that David Villa would have gotten, that Zlatan Ibrahimovic's getting, that if Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi come in those situations, you know, Sam Cronin does something crazy, he's going to get a yellow card, where Cristiano Ronaldo is probably just getting a stern talking to. And I think fans have a right to gripe about that, and they have a right to put under a microscope some of those situations where we've seen similar plays and Rapids players get punished in ways that opponents of the Rapids have not. Listeners, you can follow us individually on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi, at @LWSMattPollard. Check us out on Twitter at @Rapids96Podcast. Send us your questions using the hashtag AskHTHL. For something longer than 280 characters, if you want to have more of a conversation or get in touch, email us at Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com. Head on over to the Denver Post /HTHL for a special deal with the Denver Post. You can get 3 months of their digital content for just 99 cents a month, including all the great stuff that Mark writes about on the Rapids at the Denver Post. And then head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/Rapids96Podcast, or search Holding the Highline. If you'd like to give us some dollars and express your gratitude for this crazy, maddening content that Mark and I do for this crap soccer team right now. With that, listeners, we'll see you next week, where hopefully we're not talking about two back-to-back losses by multiple goals with the exact same problems going on. We'll see you then.
Peace! We'll